I hauled Curtis to his feet and shoved him away from me. He managed to stay on his feet, clutching at his nose with one hand and glaring at me. "You want to tip your head back to stop that," I told him. "Go ahead. I'm not going to hurt you again."
"Motherfucker!"
I held up the crystals and the little gun. "Where did you get these?"
"Suck my prick, Kovach."
Curtis tipped his head back fractionally, despite himself, trying to keep me in view at the same time. His eyes rolled in their sockets like a panicked horse's.
"I'm not telling you a fucking thing."
"Fair enough." I put the chemicals back on the bar and regarded him gravely for a couple of seconds. "Then let me tell you something instead. When they make an envoy, do you want to know what they do? They burn out every evolved violence limitation instinct in the human psyche. Submission signal recognition, pecking order dynamics, pack loyalties, it all goes, tuned out a neuron at a time, and they replace it with a conscious will to harm." He stared back at me in silence. "Do you understand me? It would have been easier to kill you just then. It would have been easier. I had to stop myself. That's what an envoy is, Curtis. A reassembled human. An artifice." The silence stretched. There was no way to know if he was taking it in or not. Thinking back to New Past a century and a half ago, and the young Takashi Kovach, I doubted he was. At his age, the whole thing would have sounded like a dream of power come true. I shrugged. "In case you hadn't guessed already, the answer to the lady's question is no. I'm not interested." "There, that should make you happy. And it only cost you a broken nose to find out. If you hadn't dosed yourself to the eyes, it might not even have cost that much." "Tell her thank you very much. The offer is appreciated. But there's too much going on here to walk away from. Tell her I'm starting to enjoy it." There was a slight cough from the entrance to the bar. I looked up and saw a suited, crimson-haired figure on the stairs. "Am I interrupting something?" the Mohican inquired. The voice was slow and relaxed. Not one of the heavies from Fell Street. I picked up my drink from the bar.
"Not at all, officer. Come on down and join the party. What'll you have?"
"Overproof rum," the cop said, drifting over to us. "If they got it. Small glass." I raised a finger at the clock face. The bartender produced a square-cut glass from somewhere and filled it with a deep red liquid. The Mohican ambled past Curtis, sparing him a curious glance on the way, and apprehended the drink with a long arm.
"Appreciated."
He sifted the drink and inclined his head.
"Not bad. I'd like a word with you, Kovach. In private.
We both glanced at Curtis. The chauffeur glared back at me with hate-filled eyes, but the new arrival had diffused the confrontation. The cop jerked his head in the direction of the exit. Curtis went, still clutching his wounded face. The cop watched him out of sight before he turned back to me.
"You do that?"
he asked casually. I nodded. "Provoked. Things got a bit out of hand. He thought he was protecting someone."
"Well, I'm glad he ain't protecting me."
"Like I said, it got a bit out of hand. I overreacted."
"Hell, you don't need to explain yourself to me."
The cop leaned on the bar and looked around him with frank interest. I recalled his face now. Bay City Storage. The one with a quick tarnishing badge.
"He feels aggrieved enough he can press charges, and we'll play back some more of this place's memory."
"Got your warrant, then?" I put the question with a lightness I didn't feel.
"Almost. Always takes a while with the legal department. Fucking AIs. Look, I wanted to apologize for Mercer and Davidson, the way they were at the station. They act like a brace of dickheads sometimes, but they're fundamentally okay."
I waved my glass laterally.
"Forget it." "Good. I'm Rodrigo Batista, detective sergeant. Ortega's partner most of the time."
He drained his glass and grinned at me.
"Loosely attached, I should point out."
"Noted." I signaled the bartender for refills.
"Tell me something. You guys all go to the same hairdresser, or is it some kind of team bonding thing?"
"Same hairdresser."
Batista shrugged sorrowfully.
"Old guy up on Fulton. Ex-con.
apparently Mohicans were cool back when they threw him in the store. It's the only goddamn style he knows, but he's a nice old guy and he's cheap. One of us started going there a few years back. He gave us discounts. You know how it is. But not Ortega. Ortega cuts her own hair. Batista made a what-can-you-do gesture. Got a little holocaust scanner. Says it improves her spatial coordination or some such shit. Different. Yeah, she is. Batista paused reflectively, gaze soaking up the middle distance. He sipped absently at his freshened drink. It's her I'm here about. Uh-oh. Is this going to be a friendly warning? Batista pulled a face. Well, it's going to be friendly, whatever you call it. I ain't looking for a broken nose. I laughed despite myself. Batista joined me with a gentle smile. Thing is, it's tearing her up, you walking around with that face on. She and Riker were real close. She's been paying the sleeve mortgage a year now, and on a lieutenant's pay, that ain't an easy thing to do. Never figured on an overbid like that fucker Bancroft pulled. After all, Riker ain't exactly young, and he never was a beauty. Got Nurikam, I pointed out. Oh, sure, got Nurikam. Batista waved an arm with largesse. You tried it yet? Couple of times. Like dancing flamenco on a fishing net, right? It's a little rough, I admitted. This time we both laughed. When it cranked down, the cop focused on his glass again. His face grew serious. I ain't trying to lean on you. All I'm saying is, go easy. This ain't exactly what she needs right now. Me neither, I said feelingly. This isn't even my fucking planet. Batista looked sympathetic, or maybe just slightly drunk. Holland's world's a lot different from this, I guess. You guess right. Look, I don't mean to be unsubtle, but hasn't anyone pointed out to Ortega that Riker's is gone for good as it gets without real death? She's not looking to wait 200 years for him, is she? The cop looked at me through narrowed eyes. You heard about Riker, huh? I know he's down for the double barrel. I know what he went down for. Batista got something in his eyes then that looked like shards of old pain. It can't be much fun talking about your corrupt colleagues. For a moment, I had regretted what I'd said. Local color. Soak it up. You want to sit down? The cop said unhappily, casting around for bar stools that had evidently been removed at some stage. Over in the booths, maybe? This'll take a while to tell. We settled at one of the clock-face tables, and Batista fumbled in his pocket for cigarettes. I twitched, but when he offered me one, I shook my head. Like Ortega, he looked surprised. I quit. In that sleeve? Batista's eyebrows lifted respectfully behind a veil of fragrant blue smoke. Congratulations. Thanks. You were going to tell me about Riker. Riker. The cop jetted smoke out of his nostrils and sat back. Was working with the sleeve theft boys until a couple of years ago. They're quite a sophisticated bunch compared to us. It ain't so easy to steal a whole sleeve intact, and that breeds a smarter class of criminal. There's some crossover of jurisdiction with organic damage, mostly when they start breaking down the bodies. Places like the Y Clinic. Oh? I said neutrally. Batista nodded. Yeah. Someone saved us an awful lot of time and effort over there yesterday. Turned the place into a spare parts sale. But I guess you wouldn't know anything about that.
Must have happened as I was walking out the door.
Yeah, well, anyway, back in the winter of 09, Riker was chasing down some random insurance fraud. You know the stuff where re-sleeve policy clones turn out to be empty tanks and no one knows where the bodies went. It split wide open, and turns out the bodies are being used for some dirty little war down south. High-level corruption. It bounced all the way up to UN Presidium level and back. A few token heads roll, and Riker gets to be a hero.
Nice.
In the short term, yeah. The way it works around here, heroes get a very high profile, and they went the whole program for Riker. Interviews on World Web One, highly publicized fling with Sandy Kim even, bylines in the faxes. Before it all could tail off, Riker grabbed his chance.
put in for a transfer to Ordam. He'd worked with Ortega a couple times before. Like I said, we overlap here and there, so he knew the program. No way could the department turn him down, especially with some bullshit speech he made about wanting to go where he could make a difference. And did he? Make a difference, I mean? Bautista puffed out his cheeks. He was a good cop. Maybe. A month in, you could have asked Ortega that question. But then the two of them hooked up, and their judgment went all to pieces. You don't approve?
Okay, what's to approve? You feel that way about someone, you go with it.
Just makes it tough to get any objectivity on this thing. When Riker fucked up, Ortega was bound to side with him.
Did she?
I took our empty glasses to the bar and got them refilled, still talking. I thought she brought him in.
Where'd you hear that?
Talk. Not a massively reputable source. It's not true, then?
Nah.
Some of the street slime like to talk it up that way. I think the idea of us ratting each other out makes them cream their pants. What happened was, internal affairs took Riker down in her apartment.
Oh.
Yeah. Ain't that a laser up the ass? Bautista looked at me as I handed him his new drink. She never let it show, you know, just went right to work against the IAD charges. From what I heard, they had him cold.
Yeah, your source got that bit right.
The Mohican looked into his glass pensively, as if unsure he should go on. Ortega's theory was that Riker was set up by some high-ranking asshole who took a fall back in 09. And it's true, he upset a lot of people.
But you don't buy it?
I'd like to. Like I said, he was a good cop. But like I also said, sleeve theft was dealing to a smarter class of criminal, and that meant you had to be careful. Smart criminals have smart lawyers, and you can't bounce them around whenever you feel like it. Organic damage handles everyone, from the scum on up. Generally, we get a bit more leeway. That was what what Riker wanted when he transferred. The leeway. Bautista tipped back his glass and set it down with a throat-clearing noise. He looked at me steadily. I think Riker got carried away.
Blam, blam, blam?
Something like that. I've seen him interrogate before. He's right on the line most of the time. One slip. There was an old terror in Bautista's eyes now. The fear he lived with every day. With some of these turds, it's real easy to lose your cool. So easy. I think that's what happened. My source says he RD'd two and left another two of their stacks still intact. That sounds pretty fucking careless. Bautista jerked his head affirmatively. What Ortega says. But it won't wash. See, it all went down in a black clinic up in Seattle. The two intacts made it out of the building breathing, grabbed the cruiser and flew. Riker put 124 holes in that cruiser when it lifted, not to mention the surrounding traffic. The intacts ditched in the Pacific. One of them died at the controls, the other one in the impact. Sank in a couple of 100 meters of water. Riker was out of his jurisdiction, and the Seattle cops ain't all that keen on out-of-town badges shooting up the traffic, so the retrieval teams never let him close to the bodies. Everyone was real surprised when the stacks came up Catholic, and someone at the Seattle PD wasn't buying. Dig a little bit deeper, and it turns out the reasons of conscience decals are fake, dipped in by someone real careless. Or in a real hurry. Bautista snapped his fingers and pointed a finger across the table at me. He was definitely a little drunk now.
There you go.
The way IAD read it, Riker'd screwed up letting the witnesses escape, and his only hope was to slap a Do Not Disturb sign on the stacks. Of course, when they did bring back the intacts, they both swore blind that Riker had turned up without a warrant, bluffed and then smashed his way into the clinic, and when they wouldn't answer his questions, started playing Who's Next with a plasma gun.
Was it true?
About the warrant? Yeah. Riker had no business being up there in the first place. About the rest, who knows?
What did Riker say?
He said he didn't do it.
Just that?
Nah, it was a long story. He'd gone up on a tip, bluffed himself inside just to see how far he could push it, and suddenly they were shooting at him.
Claims he might have taken someone out, but probably not with a headshot. Claims the clinic must have brought in two sacrificial employees and torched them before he arrived. Claims he knows nothing about any dipping that went on. Batista shrugged blearily. They found the dipper, and he said Riker paid him to do it. Polygraph tested. But he also says Riker called him up. Didn't do it face to face. Virtual link. Which can be faked. Easily. Yeah. Batista looked pleased. But then this guy says he's done work for Riker before, this time face to face. And he polygraphed out on that, too. Riker knows him, that's indisputable. And then, of course, IAD wanted to know why Riker didn't take any backup with him. They got witnesses in the street who said Riker was like a maniac, shooting blind, trying to bring the cruiser down. Seattle PD didn't take too kindly to that, like I said.
124 holes, I muttered.
Yep, that's a lot of holes. Riker wanted to bring those two intacts down pretty badly.
It could have been a setup.
Yeah, it could have been.
Batista sobered up a little, and his voice got angry.
Could have been a lot of things. But the fact is that you... Shit, sorry. The fact is that Riker went too far out, and when the branch broke, there was no one there to catch him.
So Ortega buys the setup story, stands by Riker, and fights IAD all the way down. And when they lose... I nodded to myself. When they lose, she picks up the sleeve mortgage to keep Riker's body out of the city auction room. And goes looking for fresh evidence? Got it in one. She's already lodged an appeal, but there's a minimum 2-year elapse from start of sentence before she can get the disc spinning. Batista let go of a gut-deep sigh. Like I said, it's tearing her up. We sat quietly for a while. You know, Batista said finally, I think I'm gonna go. Sitting here talking about Riker to Riker's face is getting a little weird. I don't know how Ortega copes. Just part of living in the modern age, I told him, knocking back my drink. Yeah, I guess. You'd think I'd have a handle on it by now. I spend half my life talking to victims wearing other people's faces. Not to mention the scumbags. So which do you make Riker for? Victim or scumbag? Batista frowned.
That ain't a nice question. Riker was a good cop who made a mistake. That don't make him a scumbag. Don't make him a victim either. Just makes him someone who screwed up. Me, I only live about a block away from that myself.
Sure. Sorry. I rubbed at the side of my face. Envoy conversations weren't supposed to slip like that.
I'm a little tired. That block you live on sounds familiar. I think I'm going to go to bed.
You want another drink before you go? Help yourself. It's on my tab.
No thanks. Batista drained what was left in his glass. Old cop's rule. Never drink alone.
Sounds like I should have been an old cop.
I stood up, swaying a little. Riker may have been a death wish smoker, but he didn't have much tolerance for alcohol.
You can see yourself out okay, I guess.
Sure.
Batista got up to go and made about a half dozen paces before he turned back. He frowned with concentration.
Oh, yeah. Goes without saying I was never here, right?
I gestured him away.
You were never here,
I assured him. He grinned bemusedly, and his face looked suddenly very young.
Right. Good. See you around, probably.
See you. I watched him out of sight, then, regretfully, let the ice-cold processes of envoy control trickle down through my befuddled senses. When I was unpleasantly sober again, I picked up Curtis's drug crystals from the bar and went to talk to the Hendricks.
Chapter 21.
You know anything about cinnamorphesterone?
Heard of it? Ortega dug absently at the sand with the toe of one boot. It was still damp from the tide's retreat, and our footprints swelled soggily behind us. In either direction, the curve of the beach was deserted. we were alone, apart from the gulls that wheeled in geometric formations high overhead. Well, since we're waiting, you want to fill me in?
Harem drug.
When I looked blank, Ortega puffed out her cheeks impatiently. She was acting like someone who hadn't slept well. I'm not from here.
You are on Sharia, you told me.
Yeah, in a military capacity. There wasn't all that much time for cultural awareness. We were too busy killing people. This last wasn't quite true. Following the sack of Zahiche, the envoys had been steeped in the mechanics of engineering a regime compliant to the protectorate. Troublemakers were rooted out, cells of resistance infiltrated and then crushed, collaborators plugged into the political edifice. In the process, we'd learned quite a lot about local culture. I'd asked for an early transfer out. Ortega shaded her eyes and scanned the beach in both directions. Nothing stirred. She sighed.
It's a male response enhancer. Boosts aggression, sexual prowess, confidence. On the street in the Middle East and Europe, they call it stallion. In the South, it's toro. We don't get much of it here. Street mood's more ambient, which I'm glad about. From what I hear, it can be very nasty.
You run across some last night? Sort of. This was pretty much what I'd learned from the Hendrix database last night, but more concise and with less chemistry. And Curtis's behavior ran the checklist of symptoms and side effects like a model. Suppose I wanted to get hold of some of this stuff. Where could I pick it up? Easily, I mean. Ortega gave me a sharp look and picked her way back up the beach onto drier sand.
Like I said, we don't get much of it here,
she said in time with her labored, sinking footsteps.
You'd have to ask around. Someone with better than local connections. Or get it synthesized locally. But I don't know. With designer hormones, that's likely to be more expensive than just buying it in from down south.
She paused at the crest of the dune and looked around again.
Where the hell is she?
Maybe she's not coming, I suggested morosely. I hadn't slept all that well myself. Most of the night after Rodrigo Bautista's departure had been spent brooding over the uncooperatively jagged pieces of the Bancroft jigsaw and fighting off the urge to smoke. My head seemed barely to have hit the pillow when the Hendrix buzzed me awake with Ortega's call. It was still obscenely early in the morning.
She'll come, Ortega said. The link's booked through to her personal pickup. Call's probably delayed at incoming security. We've been in here only about 10 seconds, real time.
I shivered in the cold wind from offshore and said nothing. Overhead, the gulls repeated their geometry. The virtuality was cheap, not designed for long stay. Got any cigarettes? I was seated in the cold sand, smoking with a kind of mechanical intensity, when something moved on the extreme right of the bay. I straightened up and narrowed my eyes, then laid a hand on Ortega's arm. The motion resolved itself into a plume of sand or water, ripped into the air by a fast-moving surface vehicle that was tearing around the curve of the beach toward us.
Told you she'd come.
Or someone would, I muttered, getting to my feet and reaching for the Nemex, which was, of course, not there. Not many virtual forums allowed firearms in their constructs. Instead, I brushed sand from my clothes and moved down the beach, still trying to rid myself of the brooding feeling that I was wasting my time here. The vehicle was close enough now to be visible, a dark dot at the front of the pluming wake. I could hear its engine, a shrill whine over the melancholy carping of the gulls. I turned to Ortega, who was watching the approaching craft impassively at my side.
Bit excessive for a phone call, isn't it?
I said nastily. Ortega shrugged and spun her cigarette away into the sand.
Money doesn't automatically mean taste, she said.
The speeding dot became a stubby, finned, one-man ground jet, painted iridescent pink. It was plowing along through the shallow surf at the water's edge, flinging water and wet sand indiscriminately behind it. But a few hundred meters away, the pilot must have seen us, because the little craft veered out across the deeper water and cut a spray tail twice its own height toward us.
Pink?
Ortega shrugged again.
The ground jet beached about 10 meters away and shuddered to a halt, ripped up gobbets of wet sand splattering down around it. When the storm of its arrival had died, a hatch was flung back, and a black-clad, helmeted figure clambered out. That the figure was a woman was abundantly clear from the form-fitting flight suit, a suit that ended in boots inlaid with curling silver tracery from heel to toe. I sighed and followed Ortega up to the craft. The woman in the flight suit jumped down into the shallow water and splashed up to meet us, tugging at the seals on her helmet. As we met, the helmet came off, and long, coppery hair spilled out over the suit's shoulders. The woman put her head back and shook out the hair, revealing a wide, boned face with large, expressive eyes the color of flecked onyx, a delicately arched nose, and a generously sculpted mouth. The old, ghostly hint of Miriam Bancroft's beauty this woman had once owned had been scrubbed out utterly. "Kovach, this is Lila Begin," Ortega said formally. "Ms. Begin, this is Takeshi Kovach, Lorenz Bancroft's retained investigator." The large eyes appraised me frankly.
"You're from off-world?" she asked me.
"That's correct. Harlan's world."
"Yes, the lieutenant mentioned it."
There was a well-designed huskiness to Lila Begin's voice, and an accent that suggested she was unused to speaking Amanglik.
"I can only hope that means you have an open mind."
"Open to what?"
"The truth."
Begin gave me a surprised look.
"Lieutenant Ortega tells me you are interested in the truth. Shall we walk?"
Without waiting for a response, she set off parallel with the surf. I exchanged a glance with Ortega, who gestured with her thumb but showed no signs of moving herself. I hesitated for a couple of moments, then went after Begin. "What's all this about the truth?" I asked, catching her up.
"You have been retained to discover who killed Lorenz Bancroft," she said intensely, without looking around. "You wish to know the truth of what transpired the night he died. Is this not so?"
"You don't think it was suicide, then?"
"Do you?"
I asked first. I saw a faint smile cross her lips.
"No, I don't."
"Let me guess. You're pinning it on Miriam Bancroft." Lila Begin stopped and turned on one of her ornate heels.
"Are you mocking me, Mr. Kovach?"
There was something in her eyes that drained the irritable amusement out of me on the spot. I shook my head. "No, I'm not mocking you. But I'm right, aren't I?"
"Have you met Miriam Bancroft?"
"Briefly, yes."
"You found her charming, no doubt."
I shrugged evasively. "A bit abrasive at times, but generally, yes, charming would do it."
Begin looked me in the eyes. "She is a psychopath," she said seriously.
She resumed walking. After a moment, I followed her. "Psychopath's not a narrow term anymore," I said carefully. "I've heard it applied to whole cultures on occasion. It's even been applied to me once or twice. Reality is so flexible these days, it's hard to tell who's disconnected from it and who isn't. You might even say it's a pointless distinction."
"Mr. Kovach,"
there was an impatient note in the woman's voice now,
"Miriam Bancroft assaulted me when I was pregnant and murdered my unborn child. She was aware that I was pregnant. She acted with intention. Have you ever been 7 months pregnant?"
I shook my head. "No."
"That is too bad. It's an experience we should all be required to go through at least once."
"Kind of hard to legislate." Begin looked at me sidelong.
"In that sleeve you look like a man acquainted with loss, but that's the surface. Are you what you appear, Mr. Kovach? Are you acquainted with loss? Irretrievable loss we're discussing. Are you acquainted with that?"
"I think so," I said, more stiffly than I'd intended.
"Then you will understand my feelings about Miriam Bancroft. On Earth, cortical stacks are fitted after birth."
"Where I come from, too,"
I lost that child. No amount of technology will bring it back.
I couldn't tell if the rising tide of emotion in Lila Bagan's voice was real or contrived, but I was losing focus. I cut back to start. That doesn't give Miriam Bancroft a motive for killing her husband.
Of course it does.
Bagan favored me with a sidelong glance again, and there was another bitter smile on her face.
I was not an isolated incident in Lorenz Bancroft's life. How do you think he met me?
In Oakland, I heard. The smile blossomed into a hard laugh.
Very euphemistic. Yes, he certainly met me in Oakland. He met me on what they used to call the meat rack. Not a very classy place. Lorenz needed to degrade Mr. Kovac. That's what made him hard. He'd been doing it for decades before me, and I don't see why he would have stopped afterwards.
So Miriam decides suddenly enough's enough and ventilates him?
She's capable of it.
I'm sure she is. Bagan's theory was as full of holes as a captured Sharian deserter, but I wasn't about to elaborate the details of what I knew to this woman. You harbor no feelings about Bancroft himself, I suppose? Good or bad? The smile again.
I was a whore, Mr. Kovac. A good one. A good whore feels what the client wants her to feel. There's no room for anything else.
You telling me you can shut your feelings down just like that?
You telling me you can't?
She retorted. All right. What did Lorenz Bancroft want you to feel? She stopped and faced me slowly. I felt uncomfortably as if I had just slapped her. Her face had gone mask-like with remembrance.
Animal abandonment, she said finally. And then abject gratitude. And I stopped feeling them both as soon as he stopped paying me.
And what do you feel now?
Now.
Lila Bagan looked out to sea as if testing the temperature of the breeze against what was inside her.
Now I feel nothing, Mr. Kovac.
You agreed to talk to me. You must have had a reason. Bagan made a dismissive gesture.
The lieutenant asked me to.
Very public-spirited of you. The woman's gaze came back to me.
You know what happened after my miscarriage?
I heard you were paid off.
Yes. Unpleasant sounding, isn't it? But that's what happened. I took Bancroft's money and I shut up. It was a lot of money, but I didn't forget where I came from. I still get back to Oakland 2 or 3 times a year. I know the girls who work the rack now. Lieutenant Ortega has a good name there. Many of the girls owe her. You might say I am paying off some favors.
And revenge on Miriam Bancroft doesn't come into it?
What revenge?
Lila Bagan laughed her hard little laugh again.
I am giving you information because the lieutenant has asked me to. You won't be able to do anything to Miriam Bancroft. She is a meth. She is untouchable.
No one's untouchable, not even meths. Bagan looked at me sadly.
You are not from here, she said. And it shows.
Bagan's call had been routed through a Caribbean linkage broker, and the virtual time rented out of a Chinatown forum provider. Cheap, Ortega told me on the way in, and probably as secure as anywhere. Bancroft wants privacy, he spends $500,000 on discretion systems. Me? I just go talk when no one's listening. It was also cramped. Slotted in between a pagoda-shaped bank and a steamy windowed restaurant frontage, space was at a premium. The reception area was reached by filing up a narrow steel staircase and along a gantry pinned to one wing of the pagoda's middle tier. A lavish 7 or 8 square meters of fused sand flooring under a cheap glass view dome provided prospective clients with a waiting area, natural light, and 2 pairs of seats that looked as if they had been torn out of a decommissioned jetliner. Adjacent to the seats, an ancient Asian woman sat behind a battery of secretarial equipment, most of which appeared to be switched off, and guarded a flight of access steps into the bowels of the building.
Down below, it was all hairpin corridors racked with cable conduits and piping. Each length of corridor was lined with the doors of the service cubicles. The trode couches were set into the cubicles at a sharp upright angle to economize on floor space and surrounded on all sides by blinking, dusty-faced instrument panels. You strapped yourself in, troded up, and then tapped the code number given to you at reception into the arm of the couch. Then the machine came and got your mind. Returning from the wide-open horizon of the beach virtuality was a shock. Opening my eyes on the banks of instrumentation just above my head, I suffered a momentary flashback to Harlan's world. 13 years old and waking up in a virtual arcade after my first porn format. A low-ratio forum where 2 minutes of real time got me an experiential hour and a half in the company of 2 pneumatically breasted playmates whose bodies bore more resemblance to cartoons than real women. The scenario had been a candy-scented room of pink cushions and fake fur rugs, with windows that gave poor resolution onto a nighttime cityscape. When I started running with the gangs and making more money, the ratio and resolution went up, and the scenarios got more imaginative. But the thing that never changed was the stale smell and the tackiness of the trodes on your skin when you surfaced afterwards between the cramped walls of the coffin. Kovach? I blinked and reached for the straps. Shouldering my way out of the cubicle, I found Ortega already waiting in the pipeline corridor.
So what do you think?
I think she's full of shit. I raised my hands to forestall Ortega's outburst. No, listen, I buy Miriam Bancroft is scary. I've got no argument with that. But there are about 60 reasons why she doesn't fit the bill. Ortega, you polygraphed her, for fuck's sake.
Yeah, I know.
Ortega followed me down the corridor.
But that's what I've been thinking about. You know, she volunteered to take the test. I mean, it's witness mandatory anyway, but she was demanding it practically as soon as I got to the scene. No weeping partner shit, not even a tear. She just slammed into the incident cruiser and asked for the wires.
So?
So I'm thinking about that stuff you pulled with Rutherford. You said if they polygraphed you while you were doing that, you wouldn't register. Now,
Ortega, that's envoy conditioning. Pure mind discipline. It's not physical. You can't buy stuff like that off the rack at Sleeve Mart.
Miriam Bancroft wears state-of-the-art Nakamura. They use her face and body to sell the stuff.
Does Nakamura do something that'll beat a police polygraph?
Not officially.
Well, there you...
Don't be so fucking obtuse. You never heard of Custom Biochem?
I paused at the foot of the stairs up to reception and shook my head. I don't buy it. Torture husband with a weapon only she and he have access to? No one's that stupid. We went upstairs, Ortega at my heels.
Think about it, Kovach. I'm not saying it was premeditated.
And what about the remote storage? It was a pointless crime.
Not saying it was even rational, but you've got to...
Gotta be someone who didn't know.
Fuck! Kovach!
Ortega's voice, up a full octave. We were into the reception zone by now. Still 2 clients waiting on the left, a man and a woman deep in discussion of a large paper-wrapped package. On the right, a peripheral flicker of crimson where there should have been none. I was looking at blood. The ancient Asian receptionist was dead, throat cut with something that glinted metallic deep within the wound around her neck. Her head rested in a shiny pool of her own blood on the desk in front of her. My hand leapt for the Nemex. Beside me, I heard the snap as Ortega chambered the first slug in her Smith & Wesson. I swung toward the 2 waiting clients and their paper-wrapped package. Time turned dreamlike. The Neurochem made everything impossibly slow. Separate images drifting to the floor of my vision like autumn leaves. The package had fallen apart. The woman was holding a compact sunjet, the man a machine pistol. I cleared the Nemex and started firing from the hip. The door to the gantry burst open, and another figure stood in the opening, brandishing a pistol in each fist. Beside me, Ortega's Smith & Wesson boomed and blew the new arrival back through the door like a reversed film sequence of his entrance. My first shot ruptured the headrest of the woman's seat,
showering her with white padding. The saber light sizzled. The beam went wide. The second slug exploded her head and turned the drifting white flecks red. Ortega yelled in fury. She was still firing. Upward, my peripheral sense told me. Somewhere above us, her shots splintered glass. The machine gunner had struggled to his feet. I registered the bland features of a synth and put a pair of slugs into him. He staggered back against the wall, still raising the gun. I dived for the floor. The dome above our heads smashed inward. Ortega yelled something, and I rolled sideways. A body tumbled bonelessly head over feet onto the ground next to me. The machine pistol cut loose, aimless. Ortega yelled again and flattened herself on the floor. I rolled upright on the lap of the dead woman and shot the synthetic again, three times in rapid succession. The gunfire choked off. Silence. I swung the Nemex left and right, covering the corners of the room and the front door, the jagged edges of the smashed dome above. Nothing. Ortega? Yeah, fine. She was sprawled on the other side of the room, propping herself up on one elbow. There was a tightness in her voice that belied her words. I swayed to my feet and made my way across to her, footsteps crunching on broken glass. "Where's it hurt?" I demanded, crouching to help her sit up.
"Shoulder. Fucking bitch got me with a sunjet."
I stowed the Nemex and looked at the wound. The beam had carved a long diagonal furrow across the back of Ortega's jacket and clipped through the left shoulder pad at the top. The meat beneath the pad was cooked, seared down to the bone in a narrow line at the center. "Lucky," I said with forced lightness. "You hadn't ducked, it would have been your head."
"I wasn't ducking. I was fucking falling over."
"Good enough. You want to stand up?"
"What do you think?"
Ortega levered herself to her knees on her uninjured arm and then stood. She grimaced at the movement of her jacket against the wound.
"Fuck, that stings."
"I think that's what the guy in the doorway said." Leaning on me, she turned to stare, eyes centimeters away. I deadpanned it, and the laughter broke across her face like a sunrise. She shook her head.
"Jesus, Kovach, you are one sick motherfucker. They teach you to tell post-firefight jokes in the Corps, or is it just you?"
I guided her toward the exit. "Just me. Come on, let's get you some fresh air." Behind us, there was a sudden flailing sound. I jerked around and saw the synthetic sleeve staggering upright. Its head was smashed and disfigured where my last shot had torn the side of the skull off, and the gun hand was spasmed open at the end of a stiff, blood-streaked right arm. But the other arm was flexing, hand curling into a fist. The synth stumbled against the chair, righted itself, and came toward us, dragging its right leg. I drew the Nemex and pointed it. "Fight's over," I advised. The slack face grinned at me. Another halting step. I frowned.
"For Christ's sake, Kovach!"
Ortega was fumbling for her own weapon.
"Get it over with."
I snapped off a shot, and the shell punched the synth backwards onto the glass-strewn floor. It twisted a couple of times, then lay still but breathing sluggishly. As I watched it, fascinated, a gurgling laugh arose from its mouth.
"That's fucking enough!"
It coughed and laughed again.
"Hey, Kovach, that's fucking enough!"
The words held me in shock for the space of a heartbeat. Then I wheeled and made for the door, dragging Ortega with me.
"What?" "Out! Get the fuck out!"
I thrust her through the door ahead of me and grabbed the railing outside. The dead pistolier lay twisted on the walkway ahead. I shoved Ortega again, and she vaulted the body awkwardly. Slamming the door after me, I followed her at a run. We were almost to the end of the gantry when the dome behind us detonated in a geyser of glass and steel. I distinctly heard the door come off its hinges behind us, and then the blast picked us both up like discarded coats and threw us down the stairs into the street. Chapter 22. The police are more impressive by night. First of all, you've got the flashing lights casting dramatic color into everyone's faces. Grim expressions steeped alternately in criminal red and smoky blue. Then there's the sound of the sirens on the night, like an elevator ratcheting down the levels of the city. The crackling voices of the comm sets, somehow brisk and mysterious at the same time. The coming and going of dimly lit, bulky figures and snatches of cryptic conversation. The deployed technology of law enforcement for wakened bystanders to gape at. The lack of anything else going on to provide a vacuum backdrop. There can be absolutely nothing to see beyond this, and people will still watch for hours. 9 o'clock on a workday morning, it's a different matter. A couple of cruisers turned up in response to Ortega's call, but their lights and sirens were barely noticeable above the general racket of the city. The uniformed crews strung incident barriers at either end of the street and shepherded customers out of the neighboring businesses, while Ortega persuaded the bank's private security not to arrest me as a possible accessory to the bombing. There was a bounty on terrorists, apparently. A crowd of sorts developed, beyond the almost invisible hazing of the barriers, but it seemed mostly composed of irate pedestrians trying to get past. I sat the whole thing out on the curb opposite, checking over the superficial injuries I'd acquired on my short flight down from the gantry to the street. Mostly it was bruising and abrasions. The shape of the forum provider's reception area had channeled most of the blast directly upward through the roof, and that was the route the bulk of the shrapnel had taken as well. We'd been very lucky. Ortega left the clutch of uniformed officers gathered outside the bank and strode across the street toward me. She had removed her jacket, and there was a long white smear of tissue weld congealing over her shoulder wound. She held her discarded shoulder holster dangling in one hand, and her breasts moved beneath the thin cotton of a white T-shirt that bore the legend, "You have the right to remain silent. Why don't you try it for a while?" She seated herself next to me on the curb. "Forensic wagon's on the way," she said inconsequentially. "You reckon we'll get anything useful out of the wreckage?" I looked at the smoldering ruin of the dome and shook my head. "There'll be bodies, maybe even stacks intact, but those guys were just local street muscle. All they'll tell you is that the synth hired them, probably for half a dozen ampules of tetrameth each." "Yeah, they were kind of sloppy, weren't they?" I felt a smile ghost across my lips. "Kind of. But then I don't think they were even supposed to get us."
"Just keep us busy till your pal blew up, huh?"
"Something like that."
"The way I figure it, the detonator was wired into his vital signs, right? You snuff him and boom, he takes you with him. Me too. And the cheap hired help."
"And wipes out his own stack and sleeve." I nodded. "Tidy, isn't it?"
"So, what went wrong?"
I rubbed absently at the scar under my eye. "He overestimated me. I was supposed to kill him outright, but I missed. Probably would have killed himself at that stage, but I messed up his arm trying to stop the machine pistol." In my mind's eye, the gun drops from splayed fingers and skitters across the floor. "Blew it way out of his reach as well. He must have been lying there, willing himself to die when he heard us leaving. Wonder what make of synth he was using."
"Whoever it was, they can have an endorsement from me any day of the week,"
Ortega said cheerfully.
"Maybe there'll be something left for forensics after all."
"You know who it was, don't you?"
"He called you Cov—"
"It was Cadman." There was a short silence. I watched the smoke curling up from the ruined dome. Ortega breathed in, out.
"Cadman's in the store."
"Not anymore, he isn't." I glanced sideways at her. "You got a cigarette?" She passed me the pack wordlessly. I shook one out, fitted it into the corner of my mouth, touched the ignition patch to the end, and drew deeply. The movements happened as one, reflex conditioned over years like a macro of need. I didn't have to consciously do anything. The smoke curling into my lungs was like a breath of the perfume you remember an old lover wearing. "He knew me," I exhaled. "And he knew his Quellist history, too.
"That's fucking enough," is what a Quellist guerrilla called Iffy Deme said when she died under interrogation during the unsettlement on Harlan's world. She was wired with internal explosives, and she brought the house down. Sound familiar? Now who do we know who can swap Quell quotes like a Millsport native?
"He's in the fucking store, Kovach. You can't get someone out of the store without..."
"Without an AI. With an AI you can do it. I've seen it done. Corps Command on Adarasian did it with our prisoners of war, like that." I snapped my fingers. "Like hooking elephant rays off a spawning reef."
"As easy as that?"
Ortega said ironically. I sucked down some more smoke and ignored her. "You remember when we were in virtual with Cadman? We got that lightning effect across the sky?"
"Didn't see it." "No. Wait, yeah, I thought it was a glitch."
"It wasn't. It touched him, reflected in the table. That's when he promised to kill me." I turned toward her and grinned queasily. The memory of Cadman's virtual entity was clear and monstrous. "You want to hear a genuine first-generation Harlan's World myth? An off-world fairy story?"
"Kovach, even with an AI, they'd need..."
"Want to hear the story?" Ortega shrugged, winced, and nodded.
"Sure. Can I have my cigarettes back?"
I tossed her the pack and waited while she kindled the cigarette. She plumed smoke out across the street.
"Go on, then."
"Right. Where I come from originally, Newpest, used to be a textile town. There's a plant on Harlan's world called Bellaweed. Grows in the sea and on most shorelines, too. Dry it out, treat it with chemicals, you can make something like cotton from it. During the settlement, Newpest was the Bella Cotton capital of the world. Conditions in the mills were pretty bad even back then, and when the Quellists turned everything upside down, it got worse. The Bella Cotton industry went into decline, and there was massive unemployment, unrelieved poverty, and fuck all the unsettlers could do about it. They were revolutionaries, not economists."
"Same old song, huh?"
"Well, familiar tune, anyway. Some pretty horrible stories came out of the textile slums around that time. Stuff like the Threshing Sprites, the Cannibal of Catano Street."
Ortega drew on her cigarette and widened her eyes. "Charming."
"Yeah, well, bad times. So you get the story of Mad Ludmilla, the seamstress. This is one they used to tell kids to make them do their chores and come home before dark. Mad Ludmilla had a failing Bella Cotton mill and three children who never helped her out. They used to stay out late playing the arcades across town and sleep all day. So one day, the story goes, Ludmilla flips out."
"She wasn't already mad then?"
"Nah, just a bit stressed."
"You called her Mad Ludmilla?"
"That's what the story's called."
"But if she wasn't mad at the beginning..."
"Do you want to hear the story or not?"
Ortega's mouth quirked at the corner. She waved me on with her cigarette.
"The story goes, one evening, as her children were getting ready to go out, she spiked their coffee with something. And when they were semi-conscious, but still aware, mind you, she drove them out to Mitchum's Point and threw them into the threshing tanks, one by one. They say you could hear the screams right across the swamp."
"Mm-hmm."
"Of course, the police were suspicious."
"Really?"
"But they couldn't prove anything. Couple of the kids had been into some nasty chemicals. They were jerking around with a local Yakuza, and no one was really surprised when they disappeared."
"Is there a point to this story?"
"Yeah. See, Ludmilla got rid of her fucking useless children, but it didn't really help. She still needed someone to man the curing vats, to haul the bellaweed up and down the mill stairs, and she was still broke. So what did she do?"
"Something gory, I imagine."
I nodded. "What she did, she picked the bits of her mangled kids out of the thresher and stitched them into a huge 3-meter-tall carcass. And then, on a night sacred to the dark powers, she invoked a tengu to..."
"A what?"
"A tengu. It's sort of a mischief-maker, a demon, I guess you'd call it. She invoked the tengu to animate the carcass, and then she stitched it in."
"What, when it wasn't looking?"
"Ortega, it's a fairy story. She stitched the soul of the tengu inside, but she promised to release it if it served her will 9 years.
Nine's a sacred number in the Harlanite pantheons, so she was as bound to the agreement as the Tengu. Unfortunately...
Ah.
Tengu are not known for their patience, and I don't suppose old Ludmilla was the easiest person to work for, either. One night, not a third of the way through the contract, the Tengu turned on her and tore her apart. Some say it was Kushimojin's doing, that she whispered terrible incitements into the Tengu's ear at...
Kushimojin?
Kushimojin, the divine protectress of children. It was her revenge on Ludmilla for the death of the children. That's one version. There's another that... I picked up Ortega's mutinous expression out of the corner of my eye and hurried on. Well, anyway, the Tengu tore her apart, but in so doing it locked itself into the spell and was condemned to remain imprisoned in the carcass. And now, with the original invoker of the spell dead, and worse still, betrayed, the carcass began to rot. A piece here, a piece there, but irreversibly. And so the Tengu was driven to prowling the streets and mills of the textile quarter, looking for fresh meat to replace the rotting portions of its body. It always killed children because the parts it needed to replace were child-sized, but however many times it sewed new flesh to the carcass.
It had learned to sew, then?
Tengu were multi-talented. However many times it replaced itself, after a few days the new portions began to putrefy, and it was driven out once more to hunt. In the quarter, they call it the Patchwork Man. I fell silent. Ortega mouthed a silent O, then slowly exhaled smoke through it. She watched the smoke dissipate, then turned to face me.
Your mother tell you that story?
Father, when I was 5. She looked at the end of her cigarette.
Nice.
No, he wasn't, but that's another story. I stood up and looked down the street to where the crowd was massed at one of the incident barriers. Cadman's out there, and he's out of control. Whoever he was working for, he's working for himself now.
How?
Ortega spread her hands in exasperation.
Okay, an AI could tunnel into the Bay City PD stack, I'll buy that. But we're talking about microsecond intrusion here. Any longer and it'd ring bells from here to Sacramento.
Microseconds all it needed.
But Cadman isn't on stack. They'd need to know when he was being spun, and they'd need a fix. They'd need...
She stopped as she saw it coming. Me, I finished for her. They'd need me.
But you...
I'm going to need some time to sort this out, Ortega. I spun my cigarette into the gutter and grimaced as I tasted the inside of my own mouth. Today... Maybe tomorrow, too. Check the stack. Cadman's gone. If I were you, I'd keep your head down for a while. Ortega pulled a sour face.
You telling me to go undercover in my own city?
Not telling you to do anything. I pulled out the Nemex and ejected the half-spent magazine with actions almost as automatic as the smoking had been. The clip went into my jacket pocket. I'm giving you the state of play. We'll need somewhere to meet, not the Hendricks, and not anywhere you can be traced to, either. Don't tell me, just write it down. I nodded at the crowd beyond the barriers. Anybody down there with decent implants could have this conversation focused and amped.
Jesus!
She blew out her cheeks.
That's techno-paranoia, Kovac.
Don't tell me that. I used to do this for a living. She thought about it for a moment, then produced a pen and scribbled on the side of the cigarette pack. I fished a fresh magazine from my pocket and jacked it into the Nemex, eyes still scanning the crowd.
There you go.
Ortega tossed me the pack.
That's a discreet destination code. Feed it to any taxi in the Bay Area, and it'll take you there. I'll be there tonight, tomorrow night. After that, it's back to business as usual.
I caught the pack left-handed, glanced briefly at the numbers, and put it away in my jacket. Then I snapped the slide on the Nemex to chamber the first slug, and stuffed the pistol back into its holster. "Tell me that when you've checked the stack," I said, and started walking. Chapter 23. I walked south. Over my head, autocabs wove in and out of the traffic with programmed hyper-efficiency, and swooped occasionally to ground level in attempts to stimulate custom. The weather above the traffic flow was on the change, gray cloud cover racing in from the west, and occasional spots of rain hitting my cheek when I looked up. I left the cabs alone. "Go primitive," Virginia Vidara would have said. With an AI gunning for you, your only hope is to drop out of the electronic plane. Of course, on a battlefield, that's a lot more easily done. Plenty of mud and chaos to hide in. A modern city, unbombed, is a logistical nightmare for this kind of evasion. Every building, every vehicle, every street is jacked into the web, and every transaction you make tags you for the data hounds. I found a battered-looking currency dispenser and replenished my thinning sheaf of plasticized notes from it. Then I backed up two blocks and went east until I found a public phone booth. I searched through my pockets, came up with a card, settled the call trodes in my head, and dialed. There was no image, no sound of connection. This was an internal chip. The voice spoke brusquely out of a blank screen.
"Who is this?"
"You gave me your card," I said, "in case of anything major. Well, now it seems there's something pretty fucking major we need to talk about, Doctor." There was an audible click as she swallowed, just once, and then her voice was there again, level and cool.
"We should meet. I assume you don't want to come to the facility."
"You assume right. You know the Red Bridge?"
"The Golden Gate, it's called," she said dryly. "Yes, I'm familiar with it."
"Be there at 11, northbound highway. Come alone." I cut the connection, redialed.
"Bancroft residence, with whom do you wish to speak?"
A severely suited woman with a hairstyle reminiscent of Anjan Chandra's pilot cuts arrived on the screen a fraction after she started speaking. "Lorenz Bancroft, please."
"Mr. Bancroft is in a conference at present."
That made it even easier. "Fine. When he's available, can you tell him Takashi Kovach called?"
"Would you like to speak to Mrs. Bancroft? She has left instructions that..."
"No," I said rapidly. "That won't be necessary. Please tell Mr. Bancroft that I shall be out of contact for a few days, but that I'll call him from Seattle. That's all." I cut the connection and checked my watch. There was about 1 hour and 40 minutes left of the time I'd given myself to be on the bridge. I went looking for a bar. I'm stacked, backed up, and I'm Fifth Dan. And I'm not afraid of the Patchwork Man. The small coin of urchin rhyme gleamed up at me from the silted bed of my childhood. But I was afraid. The rain still hadn't set in when we got onto the approach road to the bridge, but the clouds were massing sullenly above, and the windshield was splattered with heavy droplets too few to trigger the truck's wipers. I watched the rust-colored structure looming up ahead through the distortion of the exploded raindrops, and knew I was going to get soaked. There was no traffic on the bridge. The rust-colored suspension towers rose like the bones of some incalculably huge dinosaur above deserted asphalt lanes and side gantries lined with unidentifiable detritus. "Slow down," I told my companion as we passed under the first tower, and the heavy vehicle braked with uncalled-for force. I glanced sideways. "Take it easy. I told you this is a no-risk gig. I'm just meeting someone." Graf Nicholson gave me a bleary look from the driver's seat, and a breath of stale alcohol came with it.
"Yeah, sure. You hand out this much plastique on drivers every week, right? Just pick them out of Licktown bars for charity?"
I shrugged. "Believe what you want. Just keep your speed down. You can drive as fast as you like after you let me out." Nicholson shook his tangled head.
"This is fucked, man."
"There, standing on the walkway. Drop me there." There was a solitary figure leaning on the rail up ahead, apparently contemplating the view of the bay. Nicholson frowned with concentration and hunched the vastly outsized shoulders for which, presumably, he was named. The battered truck drifted sedately but not quite smoothly across two lanes and came to a bumpy halt beside the right-hand barrier. I jumped down, glanced around for bystanders, saw none, and pulled myself back up on the open door. "All right, now listen. It's going to be at least 2 days till I get to Seattle, maybe 3. So you just hole up in the first hotel the city limits data stack has to offer, and you wait for me there. pay cash, but book in under my name. I'll contact you between 10 and 11 in the morning, so be in the hotel at those times. The rest of the time, you can do what you like. I figure I gave you enough cash not to get bored. Graf Nicholson bared his teeth in a knowing leer that made me feel slightly sorry for anyone working in the Seattle leisure industry that week.
Don't worry about me, man. Old Graf knows how to grab a good time by the titties.
I'm glad. Just don't get too comfortable. We may need to move it in a hurry.
Yeah, yeah. What about the rest of the plastique, man?
I told you. You'll get paid when we're done.
And what about if you don't show up in 3 days?
In that case, I said pleasantly, I'll be dead. That happens, it'd be better to drop out of sight for a few weeks. They're not going to waste time looking for you. They find me, they'll be happy.
Man, I don't think I'm...
You'll be fine. See you in 3 days. I dropped back to the ground, slammed the truck door, and banged on it twice. The engine rumbled into drive, and Nicholson pulled the truck back out into the middle of the highway. Watching him go, I wondered briefly if he'd actually go to Seattle at all. I'd given him a sizable chunk of credit after all, and even with a promise of a second payment if he followed instructions, the temptation would still be to double back somewhere up the coast and head straight back to the bar I'd picked him out of. Or he might get jumpy, sitting in the hotel waiting for a knock on the door, and skip before the 3 days were up. I really couldn't blame him for these potential betrayals, since I had no intention of turning up myself. Whatever he did was fine by me. In systems evasion, you must scramble the enemy's assumptions, Virginia said in my ear. Run as much interference as you can without breaking pace.
A friend of yours, Mr. Kovach?
The doctor had come to the barrier and was watching the car recede.
Met him in a bar, I said truthfully, climbing over to her side and making for the rail.
It was the same view I'd seen when Curtis brought me back from Suntouch House the day of my arrival. In the gloomy, pre-rain light, the aerial traffic glimmered above the buildings across the bay like a swarm of fireflies. Narrowing my eyes, I could make out detail on the island of Alcatraz, the gray-walled and orange-windowed bunker of Psychosec S.A. Beyond lay Oakland. At my back, the open sea, and to north and south a solid kilometer of empty bridge. Reasonably sure that nothing sort of tactical artillery could surprise me here, I turned back to look at the doctor. She seemed to flinch as my gaze fell on her.
"What's the matter?" I asked softly. "Medical ethics pinching a little?"
"It was not my idea."
"I know that. You just signed the releases, turned a blind eye, that kind of thing. So who was it?"
"I don't know," she said, not quite steady. "Someone came to see Sullivan. An artificial sleeve. Asian, I think."
I nodded. Trep.
"What were Sullivan's instructions?"
"Virtual net locator, fitted between the cortical stack and neural interface."
The clinical details seemed to give her strength. Her voice firmed up.
"We did the surgery 2 days before you were freighted. Microscalpeled into the vertebrae along the line of the original stack incision, and plugged it with graft tissue. No show under any kind of sweep outside virtual. You'd have to run a full neuroelectrical to find it. How did you guess?"
"I didn't have to guess. Someone used it to locate and lever a contract killer out of the Bay City Police holding stack. That's aiding and abetting. You and Sullivan are both going down for a couple of decades, minimum."
She looked pointedly up and down the empty bridge.
"In that case, why aren't the police here, Mr. Kovach?"
I thought about the rap sheet and military records that must have come to Earth with me, and what it must feel like standing here alone with someone who had done all those things. What it must have taken to come out here alone. Slowly, a reluctant smile crept out of one corner of my mouth.
"All right, I'm impressed," I said. "Now tell me how to neutralize the damn thing."
She looked at me seriously, and the rain began to fall. Heavy drops, dampening the shoulders of her coat. I felt it in my hair. We both glanced up, and I cursed. A moment later, she stepped closer to me and touched a heavy brooch on one wing of her coat. The air above us shimmered, and the rain stopped falling on me.
Looking up again, I saw it exploding off the dome of the repulsion field over our heads. Around our feet, the paving darkened in splotches and then uniformly, but a magic circle around our feet stayed dry.
To actually remove the locator will require microsurgery similar to its placement. It can be done, but not without a full micro-op theater. Anything less, and you run the risk of damaging the neural interface, or even the spinal nerve canals.
I shifted a little, uncomfortable at our proximity. Yeah, I figured.
Well then, you've probably also figured, she said,
burlesquing my accent,
that you can enter either a scrambling signal or a mirror code into the stack receiver to neutralize the broadcast signature.
If you've got the original signature.
If, as you say, you have the original signature.
She reached into her pocket and produced a small, plastic-sheathed disc, weighed it in her palm for a moment, and then held it out to me.
Well, now you have.
I took the disc and looked at it speculatively.
It's genuine. Any neuroelectrical clinic will confirm that for you. If you have doubts, I can recommend...
Why are you doing this for me?
She met my eye without flinching this time. I'm not doing it for you, Mr. Kovach. I am doing this for myself.
I waited. She looked away for a moment across the bay.
I am not a stranger to corruption, Mr. Kovach. No one can work for long in a justice facility and fail to recognize a gangster. The synthetic was one of a type. Warden Sullivan has had dealings with these people as long as I have had tenure at Bay City. Police jurisdiction ends outside our doors, and administration salaries are not high.
She looked back at me.
I have never taken payment from these people, nor, until now, had I acted on their behalf. But equally, I have never stood against them. It has been very easy to bury myself in my work and pretend not to see what goes on.
The human eye is a wonderful device, I quoted from poems and other prevarications absently. With a little effort, it can fail to see even the most glaring injustice.
Very aptly put.
It's not mine. So how come you did the surgery? She nodded.
As I said, until now I had managed to avoid actual contact with these people. Sullivan had me assigned to off-world sleeving because there wasn't much of it, and the favors he did were all local. It made it easier for both of us. He's a good manager in that respect.
Shame I came along, then.
Yes, it presented a problem. He knew it'd look odd if I was taken off the procedure for one of his more compliant medics, and he didn't want any waves. Apparently, this was something big.
She placed the same derisive stress on the words as she had on my figure earlier.
These people were jacked in at high level, and everything had to be smooth. But he wasn't stupid. He had a rationale all ready for me.
Which was? She gave me another candid look.
That you were a dangerous psychopath, a killing machine turned rabid, and that, whatever the reasons, it wouldn't be a good idea to have you swimming the data flows untagged. No telling where you could needlecast to once you're out of the real world. And I bought it. He showed me the files they have on you. Oh, he wasn't stupid. No, I was.
I thought of Lila Bagan and our talk of psychopaths on the virtual beach, of my own flippant responses. Sullivan wouldn't be the first person to call me a psychopath, and you wouldn't be the first person to buy it either. The envoys, well, it's... I shrugged and looked away. It's a label. Simplification for public consumption.
They say a lot of you turned. That 20% of the serious crime in the Protectorate is caused by renegade envoys. Is it true?
The percentage? I stared away through the rain. I wouldn't know. There are a lot of us out there, yes. There's not much else to do once you've been discharged from the Corps. They won't let you into anything that might lead to a position of power or influence. On most worlds, you're barred from holding public office. Nobody trusts envoys, and that means no promotion, no prospects. No loans, no credit.
I turned back to her. and the stuff we've been trained to do is so close to crime there's almost no difference. Except that crime is easier. Most criminals are stupid. You probably know that. Even the organized syndicates are like kid gangs compared to the core. It's easy to get respect. And when you've spent the last decade of your life jacking in and out of sleeves, cooling out on stack and living virtual, the threats that law enforcement has to offer are pretty bland. We stood together in silence for a while.
I'm sorry, she said finally.
Don't be. Anyone reading those files on me would have...
That isn't what I meant.
Oh. I looked down at the disc in my hands. Well, if you were looking to atone for something, I'd say you just have. And take it from me, no one stays totally clean. The only place you get to do that is on stack.
Yes, I know.
Yeah, well, there's just one more thing I'd like to know.
Yes?
Is Sullivan at Bay City Central right now?
He was when I went out.
And what time is he likely to leave this evening?
It's usually around 7.
She compressed her lips.
What are you going to do?
I'm going to ask him some questions, I said truthfully.
And if he won't answer them?
Like you said, he's not stupid. I put the disc into my jacket pocket. Thank you for your help, Doctor. I'd suggest you try not to be around the facility at 7 tonight. And thank you.
As I said, Mr. Kovach, I am doing this for myself.
That's not what I meant, Doctor.
Oh.
I placed one hand lightly on her arm, then stepped away from her, and so back out into the rain.
This is the end of the CD. The program continues on the next CD.